Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell below us. Above us only sky. Imagine all the people living for today.
Welcome. My name is Anne Wilson, and I'm delighted to host the continuation of Emerge Australia's Imagine podcast series, in which we speak to those impacted by and associated with ME/CFS and long COVID. We also speak with healthcare and business professionals and academics who research and deliver care and support to our struggling community. I acknowledge the traditional custodians of country and their connections to land, sea, and community, and pay my respect to elders past and present, noting their continuing contributions, struggles, and achievements. This interview may contain the names of deceased persons and sensitive information with regards to health and health practices. Feel free to exercise discretion when listening to this conversation. For those of you who have listened to our podcast series, we call this our Imagine series, reflecting on John Lennon's famous song of the same name and longing for a world where there are no wars, where there is no discrimination or stigma or racism, for a world where the voices of those suffering invisibly in silence are heard, seen, and addressed. In the ME/CFS and long COVID space, we long for a world where there is a cure for ME/CFS, or at the very least, a biomarker or diagnostic test. Imagine all the people. Today, I am honoured to be speaking with Dr. Tess Ryan, a proud Indigenous woman of the Biripi country living with ME/CFS. Tess is a consultant and research associate with Monash University. She holds a PhD in Indigenous Women and Leadership in Australia. She's a writer and member of the Crokey Health social media team and interested in identity processes and building capacity for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Australians. Her emphasis is on leadership, mentorship, and education as key foundations in changing the narrative. Tess brings a strong identity and health focus to her work and has worked in areas where intrinsic value is a must and the care of individuals is paramount in creating change in people's lives. Tess specializes in communication and media presentation. She's widely published, the recipient of many scholarships and awards, and is passionate about doing more to increase representation of the needs of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in the ME/CFS space. It gives me such great pleasure to welcome you, Tess, and to say Weeaboo, Tess.
Weeaboo and Murrungbu, thank you very much for having me.
So today's yarn is going to cover lots of topics. And to get us started, I thought, can you please tell our listeners a bit more about yourself and also a bit about your own ME/CFS journey?
Definitely. As you said, I am a Biripi woman, which is in Taree in New South Wales. I wasn't born on country. I actually grew up in Brisbane and have moved around quite a lot throughout my life. I'm now at the old age of 53, although I don't feel it some days, and other days I feel much older. And as you said, with regards to my academic career, I kind of started late in my educational work. And, I've covered lots of different areas, but I guess I always started from the understanding that education was really important, and acknowledging, what happens and what goes on in the world is really important. But as well as that, from my own point of view, I was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes when I was 22 years old. So I've now been living with that for 30 years. And with that comes a number of complications. So when I started at uni, I was probably in my mid to late 30s. And I always knew that there might have been a bit of a time frame in which I had to probably get some things done if I wanted to continue on. And I found that I really loved learning. I found, I really enjoyed the processes of learning and understanding a number of things, including my own culture. Gave me a real sense of belonging and community there. And so, I went through, I got my undergraduate, I did an honours, I got my PhD. I moved from Canberra, which is Ngunnawal country, to Naarm, Melbourne, towards the end of my PhD, and then started a postdoc. But all throughout that time, even then, I noticed that I was tired. And I don't mean just tired. I mean quite fatigued. I'd go to these conferences, and a conference is usually 3 to 5 days. I'd easily have to miss at least one of those days where I just did not have the stamina to continue. I'd get a lot of different pain, and a lot of that I kind of attributed to my diabetes. And I think a lot of my medical team also probably attributed to that. And then they started looking at maybe iron deficiencies and, all these different things. Then around about 2020, late 2020, it really ramped up, and we moved house, and the house that we moved into had stairs, and just getting up the flight of stairs was becoming so difficult. And my routine was that I would wake up in the morning, I'd come down the stairs, I'd lay on the couch, and my partner would go and, prepare our muesli for the morning, and I would fall asleep in between that time. So from the time where we would walk down the stairs and he would make the muesli, I would be asleep, like fast asleep again. And we were both like, this is not right. My partner used to be a nurse. He has a fairly good understanding of health. He's like, no, something's going on here. And I was really lucky enough to find a GP that he wasn't w well versed at all, but he was young, and he was, so he didn't wasn't suffering from any burnout. And he was quite earnest in sort of, understanding, what was going on. So he really did a lot of investigations, put me through to a rheumatologist, and straight away the rheumatologist was like, you have dysautonomia, you most probably have ME/CFS, we'll send you for a tilt table test. Went and did that, and the diagnosis was fairly clear after then. So yeah, so that was sort of late 2021, and I recognize that in this space I have a whole heap of privilege. I have the privilege of education, I have the privilege of getting a quick diagnosis, even though I had the symptoms for a long time. Just the fact that from the time that I started going, what's going on here, to the time where I was diagnosed was so small in comparison to all of the stories. I've heard so many of the stories that say it takes them so long to get a doctor to listen and understand them. And I get that from a very theoretical point of view, as of being an Aboriginal woman who sometimes does get gaslighted throughout the health system. So it was just this one particular moment where it didn't happen with me, and I'm very, very grateful for that. So yeah, that was 2021. Now we're to, late 2024, I guess. And I have days where I'm definitely bedbound, and I probably have about 3 to 6 awake hours in the day, or upright, should I say, hours in the day. Depending on what the day, and well, winter time is terrible for me, by the way, and summertime is going to be terrible for me as well because of the dysautonomia. So, it just depends on the day, as we all know, as people that have this condition. And if you don't look after your health and pace yourself, you really notice difference when you crash.
It sounds to me from what you've just described, as you say, you've been fortunate in that you got an early diagnosis. It didn't take you, what, it was 2 years, 18 months to diagnosis, which is for many people with ME/CFS a short period of time, as you say. I want to swing across to looking at the plight of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. And in terms of some of the determinants of Indigenous inequality in healthcare, what are some of the challenges that you see, the major health infrastructure challenges that impact Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, specifically with regard to primary care? Because, a non-Indigenous person will say to us, "Oh, it may have taken me 3 to 5 years to get diagnosed." We hear about gaslighting all the time. I suspect that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples with ME/CFS may actually get gaslit more. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I don't profess to understand it. I'm reasonably uneducated in that space, but my gut tells me that there are just so many more issues that your community faces that we don't know about that we should be doing something to address.
Absolutely. I think, I don't want to generalize, but I think a lot of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people may simply give up in trying to get a diagnosis. And that could, definitely be a problem, because they're already coming into the health system with some pre-existing ideas with regards to government authority, health systems, institutions, things like that. One way in which I like to describe social determinants is to first take it to the individual experience. And if we look at it from a non-Indigenous experience, when you walk into a waiting room at a GP office, you're not just the list of symptoms that you're taking in with you. You're taking in with you, your identity or identities. You're taking in different, what's basically called intersections, but different aspects of your life, different aspects of your lived experience, your family life, your social life, your socioeconomic life. And so if those things aren't considered, then really all that the medical profession is looking at is the disease and not the lifestyle that might be contributing to the disease or the condition. So social determinants for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, there's lots of different examples I could give you. One example would be, say if you go from a remote perspective, so we've got geographical perspectives here, both a remote and regional perspective and an urban perspective. From a remote perspective, you might have kidney disease but live 300 Ks away from the nearest dialysis centre.
Yeah.
and get there is going to be problematic. And then they set up a service of transport, but the transport might be patchy, and you might have a whole heap of things going on in your family. You might be living in overcrowded housing because there's not a lot of housing in the cultural country that you belong to. There might be hygiene issues there because the water's not very effective. There's so much that can impact on that person in getting access to that care that they might just go, look, I just can't. It's impossible. There's too many things stacked against me. I'm not going to bother to go. That's definitely something that happens. From an urban perspective, the social determinants might be something like you're a grandmother who's looking after your grandchildren for whatever reason. Your daughter might be sick, she might be unable, the children might be in kinship care, so sort of family foster care. And you're trying to look after your health, but you've got five little ones under the age of 12 with all their different issues that you're trying to manage. You know that you're going to be the last person that you consider because you just don't have that time. You're living in uncomfortable housing, or you're trying to pay the bills, or there's so many issues that can come up with those experiences. And there's also the intergenerational trauma, and I'm sure a lot of non-Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people have possibly heard that term. As mob, as Aboriginal people, we know all too well what that means. But when trauma happens to a family, it passes down through the family. And this is for any family, black, white, or otherwise. So that trauma exists within the body. This is how we see it, Aboriginal people do. That the trauma of child removal, the trauma of police intervention, the trauma of other health issues, of just family crisis, can be such that it really impacts on whether you access healthcare or whether you're well. You might, be smoking a lot, and so that's going to impact on your health because that's your way of coping with the trauma. So thinking about these sorts of things, I think, is really important because, once again, your health isn't just one thing that sits compartmentalized from the rest of your life. So I urge, non-Indigenous people to think of it from that point of view. And as I said, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people would fully understand what I'm speaking of here.
No, I understand that. I guess the challenge that you're outlining, for someone who's not an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander person, they might be a grandparent too. They might be caring for little ones, mums with lots of kids and trauma in the household, etc. I guess I'm trying to figure out how different it is for someone in that situation who's not Aboriginal, of Aboriginal descent, who gets symptoms of dysautonomia or ME/CFS and seeks medical attention compared to an Aboriginal person who may not recognize that their physical symptoms are something unusual because of everything that their family have been through, if you know what I mean. And so therefore, not only would they not seek medical attention, but as a result of a lack of maybe knowledge or maybe lack of understanding, that this level of fatigue or symptom that they're having, let's say orthostatic intolerance, heart beating fast, blood pressure drops, passing out, that they would be more accepting of that in some way because they don't know that this is actually something you should go and get seen to. Is that, do you see that, or am I maybe making absolutely no sense?
No, I totally agree. And once again, I acknowledge that I have certain privilege that exists in the literacy that I have with regards to health. You know, I've had a lot of education through universities and through watching people within the health system that other people might not necessarily have. And I think, you know, regardless of whether you're Aboriginal or not, that health literacy really helps me. And it if you don't have it, everything seems foreign. Like, you know, I'm not a neurologist. I'm not a bio, you know, biologist, biophysicist, any of those things. I don't have that understanding, but I have enough to be able to speak to specialists in a way that, you know, they can talk to me and use different words and I understand. You don't have any of that whatsoever. And the system seems foreign to you. I guess this is the difference, I think, for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. We've already got a level of, I want to say, distrust with the system, that the system's going to care for us. And I'm sure that we'll get into that. But, you know, even something as basic as in the past, you know, one of my aunts, she was forced to have her children outside on the veranda of a hospital because they had to be separate from the white mothers, expectant mothers. So, and this was quite prevalent in our history. So the fact that there's distrust with the health system and that the health system is essentially set up by government and government policy that, you know, in the past hasn't been that great towards us, has considered maybe, you know, trying to, for want of a better phrase, breed us out or, you know, eradicate us. That makes it really, really hard for someone to go, yeah, I'll just keep going to this doctor and demand that they look after me until they reach a diagnosis. You know, so you're already burnt out because of your family situation, and then you're going into a system that you don't believe is really there to care for you. That makes things incredibly difficult. I think that is the difference. Yeah. And I can talk about some real specific reasons.
Please do.
So I might just put my own little trigger warning before this. Years ago, I worked in out-of-home family care with a young Aboriginal woman. A number of years later, we reconnected on Facebook. And I was so happy to find her again. And I was living in Melbourne. She was still living in or outside of Canberra. And it's great to hear about her life. She was 6 months pregnant with her partner and really looking forward to the future. And so occasionally we'd message each other on Facebook. And then it was about the day after New Year's Day, a couple of years ago, and I saw a picture of her with somebody else on Facebook and it said, gone too soon. And I was like, what's this about? Did a bit of, you know, looking around on Facebook and found out that she had been sick and had presented both to Tumut Hospital and Canberra Hospital around 17 times complaining of being unwell. And they sent her home with things like Panadol, if it gets any worse, come back, that sort of thing. And they just kept sending her away. She ended up getting sepsis and she passed away, as did her baby. So, you know, six month pregnancy, 26 years old, gone because the system didn't see her. And by that I mean they assumed that because she was there, she was looking for pain medication. They assumed that maybe it was a mental health issue. They assumed things based on stereotypes that they believed of Aboriginal people, that Aboriginal people are maybe just looking for attention, maybe they're looking for a place to sleep, or all these different sort of biases and things coming in. And of course, it went to an inquest, it went to lots of investigations have happened. And it was proven that, there was a failure in the duty of care, but nobody ever wants to mention the R word. No one ever wants to mention racism or discrimination, or they'll attribute it to these other things. But basically, when it comes down to it, she was denied care through a health system that's there to set, to help her. And because of that, she and her unborn baby lost their lives. Now,
Very
it took
interesting.
me, it's heartbreaking. And, I it took me a really long time to even talk about it, because I worked with both her and her mother when I was working in out-of-home care. And it was something that I didn't want to use as a teaching moment. Do you know what I mean? It's like, I don't want this to be, an anecdote, because it's not an
Well, it's
anecdote,
someone's
it's
life.
someone's life.
Yeah, it's an, a
Yeah.
real life example of a system that has clearly failed her and her
Yeah.
unborn child. And it's difficult, isn't it? Because so many assumptions are made without necessarily doing any investigations. So there's a judgment made, probably not. I don't want to say anything that'll be prejudicial, but maybe based on the color of someone's skin, the way they talk, the way they present, the value system of the people that are working. I mean, it's such a complex area, but 17 presentations is a lot. It's a lot.
And there's a whole heap of phrases and terms that we hear in the health system now with regards to cultural awareness, cultural safety, cultural competency. But really, it's about cultural humility and being able to see from someone else's point of view. So if we take it away from the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander culture, any culture, or
Yeah.
any difference in identity, even people are going to have value, their own value systems placed on that. And so
Exactly.
that becomes problematic for a trans person, for so many different people, for someone that, comes in and is disabled in a wheelchair, but they see them standing up and they get accused of, of faking it, which in our, situation can be quite, that can happen quite a lot. So
But
I think it's something that has to be thought of.
if they came in, same situation, but they had a university degree or a PhD, they would be seen immediately.
Yeah. So I wrote an article about that, about walking into a GP's office and sitting in a waiting room, and I said sitting in that waiting room was an Aboriginal person, an academic that knows about, studies race and studies health, and someone that has chronic illnesses, a female, and all those people were me. So it wasn't a room of five different people, it was one person. And that gets back to sort of recognizing that it's not just the illness that walks into that room, it's a whole entire
It's
person.
everything else, and people acknowledge status, they acknowledge qualifications. I totally understand that the vulnerable person in that situation is the person that doesn't have any of that and
Yeah,
walks
it
in,
shouldn't
and
be
it's
that
just not
way.
seen. It's they're just not seen, are they? And
And
that's
I don't, I, sometimes I don't even want to tell people, because I think, well, it shouldn't be used as a currency. It should just be that I'm me. And that those things aren't important.
It's the same for called communities. So, you know, like people who speak languages other than English, it's exactly the same. You know, there are communities and minority groups in society who would be able to attest to exactly the things that you're talking about of Aboriginal people. So it's a really big cultural issue that those who are in the delivery of services need to be able to grapple with and understand and be respectful of their
yeah.
communities. So just going on that line, clearly, in order for an Aboriginal person to be diagnosed, let's say in this situation, ME/CFS or POTS or long COVID even, et cetera, they need to be able to go to a health service. Can you tell us a little bit about the culturally appropriate health services and what the issues of trust are there? And whether, you know, that increases the chances of people going and seeing medical help.
Definitely. So Aboriginal community controlled health centres have been happening since the early 70s. The first one started up in Redfern by some amazing people that were really at the forefront of recognising that. You know, one of my favourite sayings is you can't be what you can't see. And so, you know, being able to see someone's face, being able to go into a service and see someone that looks exactly like my auntie, even though we're not related, and you just feel an instant familiarity and connection to that person plays a huge role in, you know, being able to share your experience and listen and understand. You know, it's half the work. The great thing about culturally appropriate services, medical health services, whether they're Aboriginal health services or not, is that what they tend to do is tend to think of what they call a multidisciplinary approach, or for want of a better word, like holistic.
Yeah.
They're not just going to treat one thing as separate from another thing. So when I lived in Ngunnawal in Canberra, there was an Aboriginal health service there, and every month they would have a diabetic clinic. A whole group of us would gather around in this conference room, sit down, have a cup of tea, have a bit of a yarn. Be on lists. We'd see the podiatrist there, we'd see the GP there, we'd see the nutritionist there. It was kind of like, you know, you go there for the one-stop shop. The only person you didn't see there was probably the specialist, and maybe sometimes the ophthalmologist, although lots of Aboriginal care services are now having ophthalmologists there because there's, you know, diabetic eye disease and glaucoma and things like that. But the fact is that you had a sense of belonging and community that doesn't exist anywhere else. You'd sit there and then they'd have a barbecue at the end of the day. So, you know, people would have a bit of a feed and a great yarn. And it wasn't based in negativity and deficit. Also, it felt positive. It felt like a gathering where you just happened to also go and see some health people.
It's less intimidating, isn't it?
Oh, it's fantastic. And, you know, if you think about it, you know, non-Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander people, this should be the model for everyone. Because think about those people that are out there that are really isolated.
Yeah.
They don't have a sense of community around them. They don't have support. Just having that one day would give them so much, and it would probably build and extend beyond that so that they would have areas of support. Some of these older people in the community that might not have family or friends around. So I think it's a fantastic thing, and I think without it, it does become a barrier for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people to go within, for want of a better word, a mainstream service. So a mainstream service, you walk in, you're not seeing anyone that you recognize. You're not seeing health communications on the wall that have pictures of maybe browner skinned people. You're not hearing the kind of conversation that you would hear, and you're just getting treated for that one thing, not necessarily being told, oh, there's a women's art group you can come to here every Wednesday, or there's a men's get together, or there's a good food class coming where you can learn how to cook great recipes. That has an amazing impact on people when you don't see it in a mainstream service. It's just kind of conveyor belt service delivery, which isn't as appropriate, I think.
So we know that traditional Aboriginal medical treatments include bush medicines, which I think are fabulous, the traditional healer, the singing, the chanting, external remedies. Is the reliance on traditional forms of medical treatment also a barrier, or less so, or is it more in remote areas? Can you comment on that?
Incidentally, a couple of years ago, the University of Melbourne actually had some traditional healers and medicine people come to their School of Health, which is a very biomedicine centered health space. And so the beauty of that was seeing that it can actually be accepted within a more Western framework of understanding with regards to health. But I think remote, we have remote area nurses and things like that that are out in these areas that can help to treat the condition, but they also know that they're usually called nunkeries out in that area, traditional sort of healers. To be able to do that work gives an overall sense of well-being. And, our value system, once again, trying not to generalize, but some of the things that we hold on to is caring for country is healthy, and it provides health back to us. And so we're interconnected and related to all things. So by doing that type of traditional healing and caring, by doing that work where you're sitting amongst people and you're sharing the stories, you're going through different ceremonies, has a great impact on your social and emotional well-being. And this is another term that you hear a lot in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities. But really, everyone should be thinking about that: is how is your well-being going, and how does it relate to your, I guess, physical or bio health space. So I don't know if it's necessarily a barrier. I think the barriers exist more in remote areas, distance, and coming all the way into Darwin to go to a hospital when you'd rather be on your own country receiving medical care is a really big thing. And I think in more regional and remote areas, regional and urban areas, I think traditional healing, if you have access to it, can be a great accompaniment to some of the more mainstream health spaces that exist. But you can do some of that stuff yourself. If you think about from a non-Indigenous perspective, who out there loves nature? This is the thing that I probably miss most since being sick. Is we used to go wandering. My partner and I are wanderers and bird watchers, and being out in the bush and just sitting amongst nature. For a non-Indigenous person, nature is beautiful, and it makes them feel great after looking at it. For us, it's like we're actually going and visiting a relative. We're visiting country. We're asking if it's okay if we visit. I would often go out and find a spot that was quiet and sing to the country that I'm sitting on. And for me, that's my own way of bringing in some of that healing. I'm having a communication with the earth and the country so that the country will then, communicate back to me and look after my well-being. Anyone can do that. That it's not a specific Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander thing. Anyone can go out and feel that connection if they want to. And it doesn't have to be thought of as a new age or, you know, strange. It can just be going out there and breathing deeply on country. And that's a form of traditional healing.
So that's really interesting. So I'm going to just swing back to ME/CFS for a moment. As you know, it's difficult enough for us to collect data about people who've been diagnosed with ME/CFS or people out there who've got ME/CFS, given there's 250,000 people and most of those are undiagnosed. To me, the challenge of trying to get a handle of how many people in the community, in the Aboriginal community, have ME/CFS is like looking for a needle in a haystack. Where do we start? I mean, it would have to start with having the awareness and recognition that the level of tiredness or post-exertional malaise, which people wouldn't recognize, is something that you need to have addressed and go to a doctor and see. How do we do that? Where do we start?
I think, you know, for me, education is always the most powerful tool. And so I think a good place to start would be in going into those community controlled health centres and having conversations with them, because they're at the front line. They're seeing these people every day. There's a propensity in Aboriginal health to look at, you know, the, you know, if we think about the closing the gap targets and the things that are sort of spoken about a lot with regards to health policy, they talk about things like stopping smoking, they talk about heart disease, they talk about diabetes, mostly type 2, and sort of and a diet and lifestyle related diabetes.
It's the big chronic diseases, heart, stroke, diabetes, kidney.
And what are those things involved? They involve things like high heart rate, high cholesterol. So they're probably worrying when they see a high BP and not and thinking they don't need to necessarily worry when it's a low BP or a fluctuating BP. They need to be re-educated in that space. They need to sort of maybe be presented in such a way that they go, okay, COVID's happened and is still happening. We're seeing these people that are coming back and going, Doc, I'm not getting any better, you know. So you need to doing these courses on ME/CFS to see what you should be looking out for. And then they can start having those conversations too with the patients and saying, look, when you get up too fast, do you get really dizzy? Or, you know, do you find that you're sweating like heaps, rather than you're really cold? And, you know, all of these different things that we know can occur with, you know, dysautonomia and all these different conditions. That to me is the way that we begin the conversation. I think doing this is really powerful. And I think the more we get out there and say, look, you know, and I have seen anecdotally people say to me, I've had COVID twice and, you know, I'm exhausted all the time. I can't even work. And it's like, have you thought about going and getting this checked out? Or I've seen people say, I just found out I've got POTS and they'd never heard of it before. And these are Aboriginal people. So it's wrong to think that it doesn't exist. I think we just need to get the awareness out there more, educate more people, and so more people will have that knowledge to be able to say, this isn't just burnout, this isn't just because I'm looking after a bunch of kids or I've got a lot going on in my life, there's something else going on here.
We're nearly through our questions, and this is just one that I tend to ask a lot of people. If you were PM for a day, what would you do?
Such a big question. And I'm a rambler, so just watch out. But I think first and foremost, I would work really hard to get the citizens of Australia to really understand and accept the true history of this country, to really stop and think about what has happened, and not as a way to bring shame, but as a way to go, yeah, we acknowledge this and see the power and the magnitude and the beauty of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander culture. That would be my first thing that I would really want to work on doing. And how that would form into maybe, the voice, and we won't go down that path, but that's another conversation. But then I would really want to be looking at the structures and systems that we have around us. I would want to be looking at how we criminalize people, how we treat people in the health system, how we treat people in the health system that are criminalized in prisons even, what's happening in those spaces. I'd want to be looking at housing and how housing can impact on your health. As part of working for Crokey, we've done stories on things like how climate change affects your health. And if you're living in public housing and you don't have adequate cooling, you can overheat, you can suffer sunstroke, you can die from that if you've got pre-existing health conditions. So how do we fix these housing issues so that more people are cared for, less people are going into the health system, more medicines are subsidized so people aren't having to go, should I eat this week or
Yeah,
should I
of
get my
course.
medicine? Some of the medicines with ME/CFS aren't on the PBS, they're quite expensive. So how would we be looking into that? And maybe overhauling the aged care and the NDIS systems. I think two things
Amazing. Yeah,
that they really
that's
need
a
some
very
work.
formidable list that you've put together.
I don't
I'm
dream
sure I
small.
would be delighted to be able to tackle all those things in one term of government. So, in closing off, what advice do you have to Aboriginal people listening to this podcast regarding seeking help for their ME/CFS?
The first thing I'd say is you're not on your own. It probably has felt like you're a bit on your own, that you haven't seen any or heard of anyone else out there. But you're not alone. We are out there, and just as many people that aren't of our culture want to help as that there might be people that are of our culture. So don't feel like you have to only find that community. There's a community out there. I've found a chronic illness community. I've found lots of different communities online. And the ME/CFS community is very welcoming, regardless of your race or culture. I have found that anyway.
Well, that's wonderful.
Yeah, definitely. When I've gone on the forum and had yarns on there, I found them very, very open. So I think you might feel isolated and you might feel like there's no one out there for you, but there are plenty. And I'd be more than happy to have conversations with other mob about how they're going with their health. I would love to have those yarns with people. And I think make yourself known is really important. It's important for the organisation. It's important for us to get awareness out there. It's important for the government to recognise that, this isn't just a few people. They might hear the number, but when they see the faces
Yeah.
of people, that might register a little bit more. And yeah, don't feel like it's don't feel like it that you're alone and that it's a not I don't want to say a death sentence, but something that you have to feel negative about, because there's some positives in the people that you meet And for me, the most important thing is the relationships I build one-on-one with people.
Yeah, of course.
So build those relationships. You know, they're out there.
One of the things, of course, about ME/CFS is it is a very isolating disease, given that, you know, people, you know, it stifles people's ability to work, to interact with their social group, et cetera, because of that, you know, post-exertional malaise. So, you know, there are a couple of hurdles to overcome before they get to that stage, but that's really helpful advice. What hope can we bring to our Aboriginal listeners who think they have ME/CFS, particularly any people who are housebound or bedbound?
I think that even though it appears as though nothing's happening behind the scenes, there's so much work happening at the moment. There's so much work happening in research. There's so many different areas where really smart people are getting together and trying to work out different things with regards to the brain and with regards to the gut and all these different things. And that moves us closer and closer to getting a handle on this that isn't just about management, you know, and just dealing with the everyday. It might actually lead to something even better. And I think for being bedbound, you know, I've had those days where I've woken up at 11, my head is buzzing like you wouldn't believe, you know, everything feels weighty and heavy, my limbs, you know, are killing me. And you're going to go through days where you feel just terrible. We know that. But recognize that, once again, you aren't alone, that those days you just need to pace, you know, yourself and accept and love yourself like you love country and say, look, I'm just going to be still at the moment. I'm going to pretend that I'm out, you know, on a lake or looking at the ocean and it's just really, really still, you know, and I'm just going to rest. Rest is a form of, as I've said before, form of resistance to modern day world that tells us we have to produce and we have to do this and we have to do that every minute of every day. No one has to be like that if they don't want to. You can resist that and just be. And the next day, you know, you might feel a little bit better, and acknowledge when you feel better. And the next day you might feel a little bit better still, and you might go backwards and forwards, and it's a tide that ebbs and flows, but you can get through it. And I know that I have. I know I'm really lucky. I have great support, but I'm out here in spirit supporting you too. So that's what I would say.
Thank you so much, Dr. Tess Ryan. Thank you for your time and for your willingness to share your personal views and your experiences as an Aboriginal woman with ME/CFS. We so appreciate having you as our first guest on our First Nations series. If the content of this or other Emerge Australia podcasts has triggered an emotional response for you which you need assistance for, feel free to contact Lifeline on 13114, their Crisis Support and Suicide Prevention Service. You may also go onto the Emerge Australia website where emergency services are listed. This is a platform where we can together explore the pressing issues faced by 250,000 people with ME/CFS and at least 400,000 more with long COVID. Feel free to contact me directly on ceo@emerge.org.au. And please tune in again for our next interview. And don't forget, for more information and to subscribe to the Emerge Australia newsletter, visit our website on www.emerge.org.au. Murrumbu, Dr. Tess Ryan, and bye for now.
Bye-bye.
You may say that I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. hope someday you'll join.